Today's episode is with Elizabeth, chef and co-founder of Kaizen House. Kaizen House is a business which encompasses pop-ups, residencies, collaborations, as well as permanent sites, including their upcoming restaurant in Borough Market. It's a really great episode. We touch on lots of interesting and important topics within the industry, and Elizabeth tells us how she's using her previous experiences within her new projects at Kaizen House.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, to start off, what was your first ever job?
First ever job?
Ever.
Okay, this is going to come as a little surprise. I used to be a lingerie assistant. Sounds a lot more glamorous than it is, but basically I worked in this tiny little like boutique lingerie store in Maidenhead, where I'm from. Yes, darling. And it was just like a little boutique store, but I learned a lot about sales and forward-facing customer service, and it was great. I absolutely loved it, but it was more like just something to do on the weekend, just as a, you know, weekend job. So that is, I think a career in that wouldn't be too bad, actually. No. But yeah, no, that was just something I did as a weekend job.
Cool. And then what was your first foray? I mean, have you always been very into food and cooking?
Always. I think, like, my family, like, my mum's Singaporean, so my dad's British, and so my Singaporeans, and we just live for food. It's definitely live to eat rather than eat to live. You know, you start off by, when you meet your family, and instead of saying, hello, how are you, it's always like, are you hungry? Let's go eat. And that's how you start every single conversation, and it's based around food and what you're going to eat. And even when you're having breakfast, you're talking about what we're going to have for dinner. And that's how ingrained food is in our family. So I've always been really passionate about cooking and food. I never really thought of it as a career, I think, because when I was at school, I was very pushed down the very academic route, and, you know, you've got to go to university and take that proper route. And even if I wanted to go to university, I didn't know you could do, like, a degree in food, and that was just never really an option. So I kind of focused more on what I was into at the time, so, like, architecture. I was really fascinated about design and arts, and so kind of migrated my career path to that. Again, I would probably spend all my pastime and work, like time at home, cooking and learning from my mum, watching her in the kitchen. And it's probably why I didn't do so well at university, because I was just focused more about food. So after I did my degree, I actually got dared by my fellow students to enter MasterChef, and I actually did all right in it. But it kind of solidified, like, my pathway into cooking, into having, like, a career in food, because I just felt so, despite not doing so well on that either, I just wanted to have, like, spent all my time around food and doing that, and so it just kind of, like, solidified what I wanted to do, which was cooking. So I went straight into, basically, the deep end of becoming a chef, and that was, it meant that as a, you know, 22-year-old, finished university, got student debts out of your eyeballs, as most students do, and then deciding I'm not going to have a career in architecture and become a chef. It was a really hard pill to swallow for my family. But luckily, they've been very, very supportive, always have been. I don't think I would have got as far as I had, like, without their support, because it meant that I had to move back with my parents, you know, quit the sort of, a lot of my sort of younger adult life. It was about basically studying again and working really hard. So all my pastime, instead of everyone's going out clubbing and, you know, doing what most young adults do, I'd be working long late shifts, and then on my days off I would go study at culinary school. Sorry, I'll try and pause when he's banging. So on my days off, I would go and travel into London to Westminster Kingsway, where I studied my culinary diploma, because I wanted to kind of have that think it's because I always had a studying very hard, like an academic career. I wanted to have like that certificate saying, look, she is a chef, she can cook. And so it was almost like three and a bit years of working 5 days, long hours, and then my days off studying as well. So that was incredibly hard, but I think that really toughened me up, ready for like a life in cooking or a life in hospitality, because I think I wasn't so phased then, like what would prepare me when I moved to London. I had to work, 100-hour weeks in London. I was like, I'm ready for that. But I think what I wasn't prepared for was how people treated female chefs back then. And I think that came as quite a surprise. I don't want to take the conversation too dark and serious too early on, but it was just, I think it's something that obviously the hospitality industry has changed a lot now and it's a lot better, but I think because there's also a lot more awareness. Because back then, if I complain about something, it just fall on deaf ears and be like, just get on with it, just grow up. How many times have I been told to like grow up and part, you know?
Yeah, or like that's just how it is.
Yeah, that kind of it's just so frustrating. And I think that's what's really spurred me into wanting to set an example and, wanted to set like an example and show people like that sort of behavior is not acceptable. You don't have to, everyone's gone through it in one way or another, and it's any industry, to be honest. I had it when I was doing architecture, I had it when I was also a lingerie assistant, back when you're 15 years old. So it's just like, I think that's what really spurred me to wanting not just becoming a chef, but more into being my own business owner and entrepreneur and becoming taking more control of myself and what would happen and for others as well.
Yeah, so you could have that positive impact in the industry. You could see how it could be changed and could be better. So you were having those experiences in those roles, and I read that you were kind of being sidelined and people putting you on pastry task because you're a woman. And so
I hate pastry.
Were you seeking...
I don't have a sweet tea. I would have been the worst person for it. But like, everyone's like, oh, does that taste good? I'm like, I don't really like it. I mean...
Were you seeking out kind of roles where you wouldn't be treated like that? Is that how you started at the smokehouse?
Yeah, definitely. I have a lot of respect for Neil because he was probably the first boss where I said, look, it's also maybe because all the past experience gave me a little bit of guts, a little bit of courage to say, look, boss, if I'm going to come work for you, I don't want to work in pastry. I want to learn, I want to learn about the meats and I want to learn about the garnish. I want to be on the hot section because I constantly be pushed to the sideline in terms of doing pastry work or cold starters. And it just felt like if I had to make another salad again, I would just go insane. Or if I had to make another tart again, I'd go insane. And I wanted to learn about, the real, almost like the meats and guts. I wanted to do butchery. I wanted to be a bit more hands-on and be on the hotline and show that you don't have to keep pushing someone like me on the sideline. Although every position, I think, in kitchen is extremely valuable and it is actually... Every position in the kitchen is valuable. Everyone's has their own position in a team. It's just that years of doing it, it felt like it wasn't progressing.
You're not diminishing those roles. They're definitely equally important. And some people love pastry, and that's great.
Yeah, no. There's some incredible pastry chefs. I completely respect the pastry chefs that I have worked with. I think it's a real, real art form. That's what bothers me, that cooking isn't creative, considered a creative art, because you look at some pastry work people do, it's almost architecture.
It is so really beautiful.
But that just wasn't for me. It was more for me, I wanted to learn about how to put real flavour and how just cooking all round, basically, because there was a massive gap. And that's just particularly when I approached Neil at the Smokehouse, because I'd been doing a lot of Michelin restaurants before that, working in a lot of different various restaurants across the country, and I did what most people do, go stages, so basically free work internships with restaurants who don't want to pay anyone anything, but get free work. And with the Smokehouse, it was interesting because it was about whole animal, using nose to tail, butchering, and smoking and barbecuing, and that's something I've never really come across at, like, in most of the Michelin restaurants. It's always about, you know, cooking something over a little bit of gas and charcoal, but it's not about the whole thing on there for 12 hours, like briskets. And I found that such valuable experience, and that's probably why I stayed there for so long and worked my way up from senior chef de partie to a head chef role there with Neil. I think that what I learned in that time was probably what I've taken on more with my career now than anything else before that, because it was about learning how to envelop lots of different flavours through cooking over fire or wood, and or what different types of cut meat, if you butcher it a certain way, or just making sure that you're not wasting anything as well. That was really, really valuable. But, you know, as amazing as working in sort of Michelin style restaurants and that sort of high standard restaurants, but everything's got to be concise and consistent. And I totally respect that, but that means there's a lot of wastage. Like, because just for example, say chips, we have to make perfectly like cut, triple cooked chips. The amount of potato wastage there would be because it's not perfect, it would just astounds me. And, you know, I hated that. Just the fact that we're throwing food away because it wasn't perfect. Sorry, my son. So cute. His little giggles. So I think that's what, like, driving forwards, like, working in somewhere like the smokehouse, so it was really, you know, respect every single sort of element of the food, from the meat or vegetables. Losing my flow, Riley.
Do you want to go to pigeon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The natural migration to pigeons now. Working at the smokehouse, and James and Sam approached me to, they had this idea for a restaurant. I was aware of them because they had the supper club, and I love the idea that they came to me with, that we would have a restaurant, we could change the menu every week like they do for the supper club. It's basically like the supper club evolving into a restaurant space, and they wanted a chef to work with them and to make that come reality. So I kind of just jumped at it, and I of course checked with Neil first. I was very nervous about saying that I want to move on, but he was all for it. He was like, look, it's an incredible position for you, you've got to do it, you'd be an idiot not to.
How long at that point had you been at Smokehouse?
I think it was two and a bit, 2 years?
Yeah.
I can't remember now because the whole, everything blurs into one position. But it just felt like the right time to move on, and with his blessing, I was like, all right, I'm definitely going to do it. And we opened Pigeon. It was an incredible experience because it was just, I remember searching for the sites with the James and Sam, and we were going, no, that's not going to right, that's not right. Or, and then they told me that they found a place on Wilton Way, and I was like, oh yeah, Mayfield, so I love that space. It's really, really nice little road and street. It's like a really community feel. And so it was a very, very quick turnaround. I remember getting in there and scrubbing the entire kitchen because it'd been used for like residencies before that, and so there was a lot of work needed to be done to make it into like what I would say is a sort of good standard kitchen. And in hindsight, I think I would hire the team who would tell me before then that you don't have any money or budget to when you open a restaurant. And I feel exactly the same with our new project. You just got to get real. You've got to roll your sleeves up and get stuck in. So I remember spending a good week cleaning that kitchen, trying to get it into a position where we're ready to get everything in, you know, build it upwards. And, you know, going through soft launches where the solid top breaks a few days before the soft launch, and we're, you know, fully booked with, it was 60 covers. And, I remember calling up Nesbitt's 100 times, saying, where's my solid top? And then, we had a gas range. Was it a gas? Yeah, I think it was a gas range we bought. And instead, three solid tops arrived on the same day, and we didn't have anywhere to put them, and they wouldn't fit through the door. And so we had three brand new solid tops outside. None of them I could use. I had to, like, call around. I was like, anyone, have you got any induction ranges I can use? I've got to cook and prepare for this soft opening. And then outside, I could see people just, like, driving past with their vans, wondering what's happening with these solid tops. I was like, if you touch them, I will hunt you down. But at the same time, I noticed that we got charged for those solid tops as well, so we were down quite a lot of money from the... so it's probably not a great advert for Nesbitt's, but yeah, we managed to somehow get them to come back and collect those. And we did somehow, I think we had to take things like the door off the frame, we had to basically like break the frame so we can get a gas range in. It was a tight, I don't know if anyone obviously doesn't know, but it's an extremely small space, so trying to get anything into that kitchen was impossible. But yeah, we made it work, and it was a really, I think, successful sort of soft launch. I think everyone was really happy. I think Sam were happy. And it was really exciting that we got to change the menu every week. It was a bit of a logistical nightmare because, you know, changing, I think most chefs change the menu maybe once a month, let alone four times in a month. And that meant including changing the wine list, the cocktails, but it meant that we got to be really experimental and creative in what we were producing, as well as that's really exciting for the chefs as well, like the rest of the team, that they get to see something new every week. Then, for me, I kind of felt like I could see what, after doing it for, I think it was about 15 months, but even after the first year, I felt like I really kind of see what my style of cooking is now. It was more about really harnessing the wood fire cooking, the barbecue, cooking over fire, as opposed to like gas range. Or I never did like sous vide cooking, that's just not me. And infusing sort of the Asian and more of like my background and culture sort of flavours into food. And I really wanted to do more of that. But because we were changing, the concept was changing the menu every week, it felt that it kind of wasn't focusing more on what I wanted to do. And so I think that's kind of where the birthplace of Kaizen House came. So I was speaking to my husband, who's also the other founder of Kaizen House still. And he was the one that was like, well, why don't you start something ourselves? Why don't we just, you know, why don't you open your own restaurant? Or why don't we just work on something that focuses more on what you want to do? Because you've done so much of this other stuff. And he actually came up with the idea of the name Kaizen House, because we're talking about how I wanted to improve things. I wanted to constantly grow and like learn. And we came across the Japanese philosophy Kaizen, which means to continuously improve. So it just fit perfectly with what we wanted to do. And because we are husband and wife, it just felt natural that we called it a house, a home. So that's kind of like the birthplace of Kaizen House. And yeah, I think I did make the jump of leaving, and kind of had all these ideas of what restaurants I want to do. It wasn't just one or two. I think we came up with like seven different ideas. And we had no idea really kind of like the direction of it going, other than opening a restaurant. So we put a lot of thought and energy into Shibui, which is like our first restaurant idea, and we actually got very close to opening that, but then Riley happened. So the little one in the background here, we got married, and Riley, yeah, was a little gift from the wedding. So that kind of put a real like thumbnail, like stopper in the plans for a restaurant, because it would have been impossible. Near possible, like trying to do something completely on our own and manage a newborn. So it just also, we didn't feel like it was the right time for Shibui, because I think the referendum was really kicked in just before I left Pigeon. The referendum was, hang on, June, left in October. I think with the uncertainty of Brexit, really just made us go, is doing a European, Asian, wood fire cooking, something so incredibly niche at the moment, it's the best idea. It's still an idea that I want to see, like, now that we've got a lot more experience and backing behind us, it's definitely something that's not stopped. Like, we will do it, but it's just the timing of it wasn't right. And I'm quite glad that we didn't just open for the sake of it, because for me, it's like, if we're going to open, it's got to be 100% successful and because I don't want to risk, I don't want to be one of these people that just opens a restaurant for the sake of opening a restaurant, because I couldn't do that to my staff or my employees and even like our financial backers. It just wouldn't be right. And there was just like this sort of niggling feeling that it wasn't the right timing for it. And I'm quite glad that we just stuck by our gut and just sort of focused on developing Kaizen House more as a whole. So we started with the idea of like, what could Kaizen House be if I was a chef that doesn't have a restaurant? So we opened up those areas that I would do a lot more events and residencies, sort of experiential sort of events. Worked with a lot of brands and doing a bit of consulting work, so which was great, because actually offered a lot more flexibility of having a newborn child as well as still doing what I do, which is cooking. But then, yeah, we started doing, and then we also at the same time we developed our YouTube channel, because still is incredibly talented in photography and film production.
Yeah, your videos are amazing. The production,
and that's just sort of shot in our home, well, our ex home now. So it burnt down.
Your travel ones are good as well, though.
Great. Yeah, thank
you. We loved
doing those travel ones, but they were so time consuming.
I mean,
the New York video took 3 days filming. Did a lot of editing, but I wasn't complaining about eating a lot of food either, and doing a lot. But it's just, it's just. I think everyone sees like, these sort of videos that they're easy to do, but they're so difficult. Trying to get the right lighting and shots, and then editing the amount of people that are doing fingers behind your head, and
especially the style that you're giving. You're not just giving a vlog that's kind of off the cuff, you're also putting in this like really pretty, like, is it called B-roll? I'm not sure the tech.
Yeah, it's not about just dialogue. It's the B-roll, yes. Yeah, so we try to do the videos more like that. You could feel like you're there.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's not, I'm not particularly interesting. Like, no one wants to hear me speak all the time, and other than this podcast. But, like,
no, I think the chemistry between you two on camera is really nice, but you've also got this stylistic aspect of it as well.
I think that's something that's definitely more influenced from Steele, because he loves watching all these YouTubers online, and their sort of like artistic style as well, and I think he's got a lot of inspiration from that, but also it just transcends really nicely to what we're doing. Like saying, it's not just about us, it's about how you feel and how what you can experience and see and do in that area, and it's kind of the nice transitions between it, so you can feel like you can watch us talk about this food. But for me, I hate watching people eat. I can't stand it. I said to him, we can't do videos where it's just about us critiquing. No one cares about our opinion. It's like interesting to watch. And do people learn or get any value exchange from it? And if they do, then great. They're going to keep watching it. And then, so this is kind of where the recipe sides came in. We were like, well, let's give a bit more back for free, because why not? I'll do these dishes that I just like cooking at home. It doesn't have to be restaurant quality grades. Could be like, one of the dishes, most popular videos that we did was the Hainanese chicken rice dish, because actually I think when particularly I wanted to do that video is when Waitrose did that campaign for Hainanese chicken rice. Oh, I've never been so angry at Waitrose in all my life for releasing that product, because or the recipe, it was just blasphemized what Hainanese chicken rice is. And I think that's where I started the video. I was like, we've got to do this. Show everyone. This is what makes that dish. You don't just poach chicken breasts. It's got to be an entire chicken. How do you do it? You've got to exfoliate the chicken. You've got to stuff it with the pandan leaves and ginger. Like, I know there's lots of ways of doing a particular recipe, but to call it Hainanese chicken rice, it's got to be done that sort of way. Anyway, to me as a Singaporean, that's how you'd cook it.
You think people have learned by now to consult someone who's actually got actual experience in it.
Well, that's the trouble. It's like, it's a lot of, they don't have it. They'll just go to who's got a good name or someone who's got a profile rather than experience. And I think that's like, was it the Crazy Rich Asians daughter, didn't she? She quit because she wasn't getting paid equally. Mm. Oh man.
Oh my gosh.
Because she was like, he might be experienced as a Hollywood writer, but she brought the you know, the quality or the right, you know, what made it about Singapore.
Yeah.
And in the sequel, she wasn't going to get paid nearly as much as, not even, I think it was a third what he was going to get paid next. And I think, like, it applies to a lot of things, right? Why are not more people from that, you know, particular culture and region is not involved more in creating something as mass like Hainanese chicken rice paste?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that that product was being, I just, yeah, it astounded me. Anyway, I got way off point there. But, so we wanted to kind of like share sort of a bit more about our knowledge and our background, our experiences, and like, this is what we cook at home. And I'm really, really happy with the videos, but we did have the whoopsie of burning down our kitchen / studio, so we did have to move out and put a little stop on the videos for the time being. It's just a little bit too awkward trying to do filming like that in your parents' house. No one wants to see it would have been too difficult. Way too difficult.
You can revisit it when you're ready. So tell us about the kind of pop-ups and residencies that you've been doing with Kaizen House.
With Kaizen House, we wanted to do a lot more residency pop-ups. So we did one last Christmas with Honey Spencer. So she's someone that I admire. She does incredibly well in her field, like wine. And so we were like, well, why don't we come up with the idea of doing an event together? She just started doing Bastarda back then, about a year and a bit ago. And we were wanting to explore doing more residencies or pop-up with Kaizen House. And we were like, let's just do something really luxurious and really indulgent for Christmas, because that's what everyone wants to do at Christmas time. So we came up with the idea of doing the little dinner at Narrowway Studio. Because Narrowway Studio, we were the first ones to do like the pop-up there. They said they've got this amazing space. Tiny. But I was like, I'm used to cooking in tiny places. It's really tiny. We squeezed in 30 people each night for 3 nights. And yeah, it was a really amazing experience. Honey brought over these amazing like wines in her suitcase, and brought all that travelling that she does as well. And it was an amazing event. And then I wanted to do something that was a little bit, like in the new year, I kind of wanted to do something that was a bit more than just like a one-off night. So we were approached by Mortimer House to do like a residency there. And I was like, amazing, we want to do something that wasn't just 1 or 2 days, or 1 or 2 weeks. We were there for 2 months. And that was great, because it meant that I could do, like more people could see and try our food, or my style of food, that I was like pushing a little bit more towards about what my background is, like Singaporean background and heritage. I kind of wanted to merge that again, like I said, back in Pidgin, I kind of developed this sort of style that I wanted to test. And the response from the food and the guests was amazing, and it just kind of gave me a little bit of resurgence. I wanted to go to a restaurant again. So we did like a couple more events here and there, more like private ones, but then we got the opportunity to do this project in Barrow Market, and I was like, everyone's doing market halls or some sort of style market these days. So I was like, no, we've got to do a restaurant. And then I think I was pushed again a bit, quite a lot by quite a number of people saying, no, you've got to do this project. And I was looking at it, and I was like, oh, okay, why is everyone bugging me? All right, I'll look into it. I'll give it a bit more time. I looked into it and I was like, I'm an idiot. This is an amazing opportunity. And in such a historical spot like Barrow Market. And I didn't realise, because that I thought it would be like a cookie cutter sort of style where everyone moves in and you run and operate as, you know, it's almost like I said, going into a residency.
Yeah.
But this one is more about, again, it's more about the market. It's all about, using the suppliers and traders that are already existing there, the wholesale market that they have in the market. And unfortunately, financially, we've got to build it ourselves, but it meant that we had a lot more say on how we want it to look and feel. And that's also been something really important to me, because I felt with a lot of the market halls, it's very,
it's quite cookie cutter.
Singular sort of experience that it just, you don't really get anything much from that brand.
Yeah.
Other than the food. And for me, obviously, for me and for Steele, like Kaizen House, it's all about how you feel in that space. Mm. and that's really important to us. So we came up with, we had this, well, like I said, we've had all these ideas bubbling away, and we had one of the concepts was this casual sort of dining experience, Mei Mei, which is basically Singaporean street food, kopitiam concept. And I was desperate to kind of work on this a bit more because it is a very passionate, like, it's a very personal project. It is Singaporean cuisine. It's stuff that I miss all the time when I'm here, like in London. But when I'm away, when I live in London, it's like comfort food, like stuff that I've been brought up on here in the UK. My mum's cooks incredibly well. And so all the little dishes, like Hainanese chicken rice is a very important dish to me, as you probably can guess. But I was like, why don't we just do something that I love cooking and don't mind, you know. I just wanted to cook that style of food and that dish and bring it to the people, like, in Borough Market so that everyone can sample. And, yeah, so basically that's where it's all migrated from, the events side to... Mm. With Kaizen House, I think I'll just quickly interject. Kaizen House, it was almost, we established it, it's like you say, it's based about being a family and a unit that had these sort of three tiers that we came from. So we have the YouTube side, we have the restaurant side, but we also have the family side. So, like, you kind of get a sense that belonging to something. So it's always wanted to create like an incubator. That our blue sky thinking is that people, we would work with people that we admire and who have the same sort of values, and that would come on and we would, you know, grow projects together. I think that's where Kaizen House and the heart of it really stems from. But yeah, the restaurant side. So Mei Mei is the first project. I'm actually really happy that the first one is going to be based around our heritage, and I just can't wait for it to open.
Yeah, when's it due to open?
Oh, that's the magic question, yeah. Isn't it? When does it... That's the sort of the anxiety question, isn't it, for every restaurateur when they're opening a restaurant. We're aiming for mid-November, but it really depends on quite a lot of factors.
Yeah,
everything. Just stay tuned.
Yeah, and what kind of things can we expect? So it's 12-cover... counter restaurant, or is it quick service?
Yeah,
then it,
so with Borough Market Kitchens, they wanted to they based the whole thing, like I say, it's not like the cookie cutter market. Well, it's, they based it, so they said to us, imagine Barcelona, the boquerias, so where you sit around the kitchens and the restaurants and you get to watch everyone work. So that's what it's based on. So we have designed ours with, it's technically 13 seats, but I'm super superstitious. So I'm like, we're squeezing another person in. It's 14 seats, 12 if there's... anyway, it's 14 seats, and everyone is basically, it's just an entire kitchen, so you'll get to watch everything from start to finish, and you're sat around the outside. But I kind of took it, I pushed it a little bit further. I challenged, like, still in our designers a bit more. I was like, I just don't want it to be bar counter seating. For me, as a mother, I want to sit down and have a meal with my son. It's impossible on a bar counter stool. So I was like, it's really important. Can we get, like, at least, even if it's not like a full, like, table, can we get, like, some sort of, like, chef's table or sort of seating area that's not on a high stool, even if it's a low stool? Because then, again, it's about the experience of having dinner together or a meal together. So there is, like, 4 to 6, depending how close everyone likes sitting to each other. It's 4 to 6 seats around this, like, what we call a chef's table. I think they're only calling, it's not really a chef's table, they're only calling that because maybe because I pushed it to be in there. But you get to watch, it's right next to the counter where you can, we're building a coffee bar, Gopi, which is Singaporean coffee. It's got K-O-P-I. And there's a real theatre when you make the kopi and tea. So it's because it involves a lot of pulling. So you imagine you've got almost, they look like watering cans, but that's where you put the coffee in. It's grounded coffee and ground, like, tea dust, that's what we call it. And you have like a filter sock. I'm not going to say what that looks like, but it's a sock. And you basically pour the hot water and you pull it between these two watering, like, two cans. And You want to get the air, and because it cools it down, adds some bit of aeration into that coffee or the tea, and it sort of infuses, you're kind of mixing that hot water around, so it infuses all the, and I love that theatre of that. And so we designed the chef's table, so it sat right in front of that, so you kind of get to see it, hopefully not too much splashback, but that was really important. Like, I really am excited to see how everyone reacts to that sort of coffee. Coffee's not introduced to London properly yet. I don't think anyone knows really what it is or tried it. Because imagine it's a single coffee is like, you know what everyone associates like Vietnamese coffee here, where it's condensed milk and the sort of dark drip through coffee. It's really similar. I prefer. I'm completely biased here. I think Singaporean kopi is an incredible flavour because it's three different types of beans that are caramelised. So they've got this real like toffee, caramel, chocolate sort of flavour notes. And I say I don't have a sweet tooth, but you can add a dollop of condensed milk and evaporated milk into this coffee, and it's just really indulgent. And for me, that's the best start to any morning. Get these cappuccinos and espressos where everything's completely bitter and horrible if it's done wrong. Coffee is the best way. And so with a signature coffee that we have in Singapore is what we call Kopi Goyu, which is butter coffee. So very similar to maybe like bulletproof coffee. You have the kopi, condensed milk, and a slab of butter on top. And you just let it melt. You don't stir it or anything. You just let it melt. There's a real nice theatre in it. And then you stir it, and it just is incredible. It changes the flavour profile of the coffee really, really nicely. Like, it's just, you know when something just feels really nice in the mouth, it just coats your mouth nicely, and it's not overwhelming, it's not fatty, it's just, it's almost like creamy, but without any actually, you know, cream in there. And so we're doing that as one of our signature coffee dishes, offerings.
Sounds amazing. Like, can't wait to try that.
I think I just can't wait to show everyone like different variations of coffee. And I'm going to do it like very traditional. We're going to have all the, you know, the correct pronunciations of how you'd order it. So there's Kopi C, Kopi O, or Kopi. That means like, you know, whether you want black coffee or with milk, evaporated milk, or without sugar. And it's just kind of like, we're excited to almost like educate everyone like this different offering. So there's that, and the main dishes for May is all about the Hainanese chicken rice.
So maybe we could go into here kind of kitchen culture with your previous experiences. You're looking to change that.
Yeah.
So how and what kind of strategies will you be implementing through projects with Kaizen House?
I think this is where, May is really, like, we get to implement some of those ideas, not only being the first restaurant project we're doing, but also that we are in this benefit that we are part of this market and a community. So really focusing on, like, making sure that the project feels like it is part of a community. We interact with all these different traders, we work with all these traders, but also that we work market hours, so it is a 10 to 5 operation. We don't do dinners service. I think that's really attractive, not only for me as a mother and business owner, but I know as a business owner, I'll probably be like, we need all the hours possible. Because they're going to be doing 10 to 5 or 10 to 6, it means that people actually can have a life outside of work.
Yeah.
And I am really pushing, like, we're going to be implementing flex work. So, you know, you can start early as you want. So before full trading hours, so like 8 o'clock in the morning, we're doing a bit of prep. And then if you want to finish earlier so you can pick up your kids from school or nursery, you can. And our busiest period will be, obviously, this busy lunch period. As you know, you go down to Borough Market on a Saturday, and you're almost like swimming to get through to the other side. So I'm really, really pushing for this sort of flex working, so part-time, hourly work, so that it gives that people the opportunity. Even if they're not parents or family, have families, it's like if you want to go and work in a restaurant in the evenings, then you've got that opportunity. I'm not even going to push people. Like, just let me know up front. Just be honest with me what you want. We'll make it happen. And I think just having like a business owner being that approachable for your staff, that makes it a lot, takes a lot of the stress and anxiety out, as particularly for me as a mother, that I can say, look, I need to be off for Friday, or I can't come in. If you give me enough notice, I'd be like, I can't come in, I've got to look after Riley. Then I completely understand that and respect it. So I think just having those sort of changes makes it a lot more, I don't know, it just makes it a bit more forward thinking, I think.
More accessible.
Places, yeah, I know a lot of places can't offer that, but then you're obviously not trying hard enough to incorporate these initiatives, or you might have to hire more people, but then if you balance it correctly with what what else is happening in the business, then anything's possible.
Yeah.
And by being attractive, like having sort of those flexible hours, or respecting people, like if you're a mother as a chef, I think that people will stay with you longer. Because
you
have something that not many other places are offering at the moment.
Yeah, and that's got such a huge value. It's not just about a salary, it's also about...
Yeah, and then just touching on salary, we're paying everyone London Living Wage, which a lot of places don't do in hospitality, because, again, I know the margins are tight, but then I'd rather pay a little bit more for, staff that are going to stay with us longer, because it costs a company a lot of money to rehire and train people, because time is money.
Yeah.
And so just eliminating that area, it could happen. People will leave you because they need to move on and circumstances change. But just knowing that people kind of got that safety bracket that, you can change your hours, or you get paid well for what you do, then...
And then you've got the benefits of having people working with you who are actually enjoying their job and want to be there. And that's a positive for the business as well, the consumer.
I go into cooking because I love cooking, and that applies for a lot of people in hospitality. We're not doing this to be millionaires, let's be frank. But it's a passion career, it's a passion job. We love cooking because I love cooking, and I love being around food, I love being around a team as well. I like being a leader because I like mentoring, and I like watching people grow. As what chefs have offered me in my career as well, I've had great mentors in my past and current, but it's just a lot of places don't offer it. And I say those are the fundamentals about Kaizen House. If we're going to have the restaurants, we've got to have those sort of ideals that, it's approachable, it's appealing for people to want to work at, but also be fun. And that's why we do things like the videos. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's we're not taking ourselves too seriously. It's it is what it is, but we try to give something back as well.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
I was interested to find out how your studying architecture has influenced your cooking or your work around cooking, the business.
And other than doing lots of pastry work. No, the two studies have been completely the same, actually. Like, there's a lot of principles, the disciplines, quite parallel. So you learn about people management, money management, time management, you're creative, hands-on, you're constructing something as well from scratch, and then seeing it all the way through, obviously. A building takes a lot longer than doing a pie, but I think both of them have all actually gone hand in hand, and I've learned a lot more about people management and money management, a lot more in cooking. I think one thing maybe in culinary schools that you really need to focus more on is about people management and people managing themselves, like emotional intelligence in our field is incredibly important, and how to control is like how to just sort of manage difficult situations, because it's very high pressured situations in cooking. So I think they're both kind of been hand in hand. I don't think if I hadn't done my degree in architecture, I wouldn't have done so well in cooking.
That's interesting.
Because, like I say, so many of those things, I kind of already knew how to budget. Mm-hmm. I already knew how to manage a team on Dura Rota or project manage almost. Also, it's come damn in help handy when designing your own restaurant.
Yeah, for sure.
Just learning how, knowing how to read, you know, a design schematic and software, and it's just been very, very, it's actually helped me in a couple of instances when we've been looking at other sites and people think they can pass things through us without, you know, obviously they didn't realise I had a background in architecture, and they sent me some CAD drawings, and it's place, things have been in the wrong places, basically, let's put it that way. So we were able to just move past that project quickly.
And the architecture of the restaurant is so important when you're eating. I love all the, I don't know, I'd like to kind of find out more about how, you know, the height of the chair compared to the table and like the materials and all of that just all comes into your experience of your eating.
It is. It's like,
fascinating.
Obviously, budget really defines on someone's experience. You know. But that's one of the areas in my degree that I focused a lot on was the spatial design.
Yeah.
So that essentially is like the design of the space and how that makes a particular person or group of people feel. And so when we designed our space in Borough Market Kitchens, I'd say that a set of things like having that chef's table with this lower stool so, you know, you can feel your feet touching the floor. And then to Still and I, going to Singapore recently and hauling back over 70 kilos of tiles, floor tiles, from Singapore in our suitcases. Yeah, we bought a lot of luggage. But, you know, you can feel your feet on the floor when you're having your dinner, and then you can look down and you'll see these authentic, like, the original Peranakan tiles that you have in the Kopitiams in Singapore. Like, little things like that.
Mm.
And the details, I think, means a lot to me, and I'd hope it means a lot to the person that will be sitting in that space.
I think it does, even if it's subconscious.
Yeah, exactly. Even if you don't notice the specifics when you're in a well-designed...
Even if it's just one person that goes, oh, those tiles are nice. That just, you know, that makes lugging 70 kilos worth of, with incredible anxiety throughout the whole flight. Every time we had turbulence, I was like, no, tiles! Like, poor Riley had no clothes for the holiday, but... Then we had, you know, and for me, like, we were, you know, we went to all the, it's still going to the big catering stores and things like that. We went to all the little family-run businesses down the streets. We were staying in Singapore, and I just think it's just nice supporting them as well, and rather than getting a mass-produced, you know, particular, obviously price helps, but, and the fact that we were lugging it all back.
Yeah.
I'm hoping customs doesn't pick up on this. So.
Yeah,
podcast
stuck to the floor.
It's stuck to the floor. Yeah, but I think for me, it's like particular details like that that, you know, it just makes it makes that project even more personal to me, us, and I like to think that other people will appreciate those little bits. We've also had to factor in like, being sustainable and very environmentally conscious. Yes, it's not great like flying to Singapore and bringing back tiles, but then we've factored in a like recycled plastic countertops. Everything's recycled or sustainable materials. What else have we used? Yeah, no single-use plastic, things like that. All the packaging that we're using is biodegradable.
And you're sourcing, like, your meats and things.
Yes, everything. We've got, like, we're working with the Ginger Pig, so they're a supplier in market. And I've been doing, bless my poor family, I've been constantly making chicken rice for months and months. But we've been testing all the right different chickens. And they're amazing, like, amazing produce here in the UK. The Ginger Pig, it makes sense that we'd work with them, that they're in the market. Barra wants us to use traders that are in the market. I absolutely think that the Yorkshire free-range Yorkshire chickens that we're using are perfect for what we're doing. It doesn't need to be, like, the biggest, most expensive chicken. It just needs to be, like, good quality free-range chicken. And that's what gets you the best. Because you don't want something that's too overpowering. You have this 100-day-old chicken that is, like, bigger than the size of turkey. And I was like, that's great, but poaching it is going to take me way too long. It's too dark a colour in the meat, but it would be perfect for like a curry dish where I can braise it a bit longer and you know, it kind of masks a bit more of that dark colour meat. But, and it has this real rich gamey flavour, which you can't get that in Singapore. And all it, like, the heart of our cooking is that you're using the best produce that you can get around you. So we're not going to be getting really, you know, importing lots of Asian greens. So we're not going to be importing, we're going to be using whatever we can get in the market, fresh, and going to harness that opportunity. And yeah, just make really delicious food that's, again, not too serious.
Mm.
We're going to be introducing, I think, what would be probably a bit shocking to Singaporeans, doing fried chicken with the chicken rice.
So doing it with the caviar.
You could do it with caviar. but essentially it's like we want to kind of like make a little spin on things, because fried chicken's been like so popular, but having that with the rice, and it's kind of making like a new chicken rice. But again, I have complete respect with the old, the traditional recipe, so we're not, you basically get to both offerings.
Yeah.
And if you want caviar on it, I guess we can throw on the caviar, why not?
Okay, so obviously we've touched on the fact that you have a family, you're a mother. How was your experience with being pregnant, working in kitchens, and now being a mother and having a family that are obviously important as well while running a business?
My experiences of, like, I think just stemming from how people treat you almost. I think this is across like every single person that has, who's been pregnant. But as soon as you are with child, people treat you differently. And it kind of, I was always wanted to be like, I don't know, it's because I'm extremely stubborn, but I was like, I'm going to be working until the last day because I get so much pleasure out of working and working hard. And whether I'm going to be pregnant or not, I'm going to be working. But I know that's not the same for everybody. I think that employers need to respect that. For the start, though, like, even before I'm pregnant, when I became I can't say where, but I've had a number of bosses say to me, don't get pregnant, or don't get pregnant in the first year. And it's like, you can't tell me, you can't say that. It's not your choice what I do with my body. And I think that attitude just needs to be erased completely. And I wish I was in a position I could say where that happened, but I can't. But
it's actually also illegal to say that to an employee.
It's hard to say, like, my word against theirs.
Yeah.
But, so that straight off. So I was like, well, you know, it's not a condition, you know. I'm pregnant, I'm just with child. So I've always, you know, I love cooking, so I was just going to be in the kitchen. But it is hard because you're not only, you've got the nausea, and I remember only one and only time I had morning sickness was when I was doing live TV. I was on Saturday Kitchen.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, I got past this, what they call the safe zone. So it was past 12 weeks. So I was 14 weeks pregnant, but it was still hidden from the public. And so I don't think I told my parents by that point, actually. Anyway, so we're doing this filming. It's 8 in the morning. Obviously, you've got your glasses of wine. It's all very nice having wine in the morning. Obviously, I wasn't drinking. I was pretending. Just take a note there. But I remember Tim from Chule was on the show with me, and he made his amazing cacio e pepe dish. But it's probably the worst thing for me to ever want right in front of me early in the morning when I was going through morning sickness. And I just remember having this, like, bead when they brought it to the table, and got to be like, oh, try and tuck in and try some. And I was just like, I remember this bead of sweat just coming down the side of my temple, and I was like, don't throw up on live TV, don't throw up on live TV. And I was like, almost, I was scanning where the nearest sinks were. I was like, I didn't know whether the producer got a sense of panic to see me just be like, oh, just play it cool. And I was like, cut to VT, and I was like, yes, go.
That's
stressful.
Awful.
It's really funny. I just gotta laugh at those sort of memories. Thanks, Riley. I would never really recommend working those sort of very long hours. I remember cooking at the OFM Awards. I think there must have been over 1,000 people that they were at that event, and I was cooking with 3 other amazing chefs. But I was on my feet for nearly the entire day. Now, I think I was about 7.5 months pregnant, and I was just remember feeling just like really unwell, like almost like flu-y. And I remember saying, I can't push this. So I think that's where I kind of like drew the line. I was like, you just got to put your feet up and just enjoy, you know, the last few moments of being pregnant. And I think it's really up to an individual person whether they want to work or not. And if they want to, how can, as an employer, you make them, you know, what's the what do they want? You can't tell, you can't impose on what, you know, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. But I think if someone wants to work, like, in a kitchen, then let them be in the kitchen, but let them have more breaks, or let them sit down for a few hours, or have more, you know, more, damn, I ate so much as well. So let them go on more lunch breaks. And I did, it's just really up to that individual to be able to communicate that so freely with a boss that they need something, they want something else, or need some change. Again, though, with the maternity leave, it's not really a standard, it's all statutory. So I think that really affects people's opinion. Like, it's difficult because statutory is, that's really something the government needs to improve on. Statutory is absolutely appalling. No one can live on in London, particularly, on £140 or less, I think it was, a week. Let alone our rents, you know, who, if you're on your own, then how do you pay for rent? Like, it's just, yeah, I think it's just...
Impossible.
Yeah. You've got to have a real big village and support network and community around you. Again, so that was a massive factor in us wanting to make a better change in our company and offering for people who have family. Because, you know, families contribute to communities. Communities is food, like, everything... Food doesn't, it's just, it's all connected, and yeah, I think
that's a basic human right, really.
Yeah, and why should people's careers and work and where they live like contribute, impact it? Yeah,
I definitely agree. I'm sure most people do,
but yeah, it doesn't stop me from wanting more children. Yes, darling, sorry,
good timing there.
Yeah. So, yeah, should we wrap up there?
Yeah.
And say where people can find more about you.
You can find us on our website, like kaizenhouse.co.uk. And also, we've got the YouTube, which hopefully will be kickstarting something. Sorry, my son's really distracting. I actually really am trying to push for a project. I think we're just pushing, again, us to the limit almost, but I want us to almost document our opening and the journey of opening May.
That'd be really interesting.
From the start. So, I mean, that'll be offering something that to our YouTube channel that a lot of people don't get to see the ins and outs and the difficulties. Like, you're not just a chef. I'm, like, having to learn about plumbing and electricals. Still keeps going on about kilowatts and amps and how, you know, because we've got the limited sort of connection being in a shared space. And I'm just like... You completely lost me again. I know I already did a section of this in my degree, but I can't, like, down to, like, plug sockets and the cost of them. It's just, there's so much to consider.
Every tiny detail.
Yeah, and I love that. Like, I love, like, the design and learning aspect. I think it's very easy for as business owners, but also as chefs, we were like, we could have just... partner with someone and just let them take the worry and hassle from it. But I think the learning and experience for our side and then able to share that with others is just so valuable, and we want to share that. So we're going to see if we've got time to film and document this. So if we do, stay tuned. May should hopefully be open in mid-November to say with a grimace. As long as there's enough testing, operational tests, I'll be happy. As long as we've got a gas stove or a solid top, I'll be happy. And yeah, I think keep on our Instagram is what we communicate a lot with our followers and people who are interested in what we do. So we'll always be updating that daily almost.
Exciting.
Very stressful.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find us on Instagram at What's Cooking Podcast, on Twitter, What's Cooking Pod, or drop us an email at the What's Cooking Podcast @gmail.com.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review, and 5 stars.
Bye.